This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna Padgiri, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Ketaki Chokhani and Craig Wine. Ketaki Chokhani is an assistant professor at the Manipal Center for Humanities, Manipal Academy of Higher Education, Mahe, Manipal, India, where she teaches India's first ever course on single studies. She is a co-editor of Singular Selves, An Introduction to Single Studies, published by Routledge in 2024, and also an author of The Limits of Sexuality Education, Love, Sex, and Adolescent Masculinities in Urban India, Routledge 2024. Her other writings on gender, sexuality, and singlehood have appeared in the Indian Journal of Medical Ethics, the Journal of Porn Studies, the New York Times, Square Peg, and The Hindu, as well as in edited volumes published by Routledge, Cambridge University Press, and Temple University Press. Ketaki is also an avid birder who dabbles in music composition and painting and is training for the national level master's swim meet. Wow, that's quite a bit of an introduction. Well, the second editor is also no less. Craig Wine is an associate professor of English in the Division of Arts and Humanities in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of the District of Columbia. He is the co-author of Singular Selves, An Introduction to Single Studies, brought out by Routledge in 2024, and How to Be a Happy Bachelor, Kendall Hunt, 2020. He has presented at a variety of conferences on these subject areas, and his work has been published in Teaching English in the Two-Year College, Journal of Creativity and Mental Health, Journal of American Culture, Spark, a 4C4 Equality Journal, Revista Feminismos, as well as Psychology Today and Writer's Digest. He has themed his first-year writing courses around single studies and has also taught a course, How to Be Single and Happy Without Looking for a Partner. Craig enjoys running, cycling, and is an avid concert goer and blogger. Ketaki and Craig, I welcome both of you to this podcast and thank you so much for giving NBN the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you, Tuparna.
Actually, when I was going through the introductions, I felt very excited to speak to both of you. And I'm so sorry, Craig, for the mispronunciation. My apologies. It's Craig Wynn. So let me begin by asking you both about the context in which this book is written, if you could talk a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So Ketaki and I, we've both been members of this Facebook group called Community of Single People. We use COSP to abbreviate it. And we've been members of this group for a number of years. I came on around 2015 when Dr. Bella DiPaolo started the group due to a developing interest that I had in single studies. And I've been reading, researching, and writing about it for years. And then around 2020, I came across Ketaki's syllabus for a single studies course. And I was very intrigued because I was teaching a undergraduate course called How to Be Single and Happy. So I just reached out to Ketaki and asked for a syllabus just because I was curious about it. And that led to us having a monthly chats about these topics. And when the lockdown happened due to the pandemic, we decided it would be a very good idea to put together a conference with respect to single studies, just because there's so much interesting work being done about this. And we reached out to a number of people from different disciplines, and we had the conference. It was a success. So we had approximately 300 people in attendance, and that led to a book being published. We had the conference as part of a collection. It would lead there, so it took some time, but we were able to put all of these essays together into this collection, just from all of these different disciplines. It's been great.
Right. So could you also talk about the theoretical and conceptual ideas that you use in this book?
Yes, absolutely. So the thing is, the book is the theoretical and conceptual ideas that we use in the book are based on single studies, and that is what we have laid out in the introduction itself. And primarily one of the terms that is used, I'm sure, with the other scholars as well, the other contributors in the book, is the concept of singlism, which is the discrimination and stereotyping of single people. So this was a term coined by Bella De Paolo as in the mode of consciousness raising, and it was added in the dictionary a couple of years ago. So we have generally used, you know, singlism is something that a number of the other contributors have used, but as well as other terms like matrimania, like procreamania, which Craig has coined, or terms like emetonormativity and mononormativity, and couple culture. So there are many, many terms and concepts which we define in the introduction, which have been used in the book.
Right. Since this is something very new for a lot of people and perhaps even our listeners, let me begin by asking this basic question. What is single studies and why is it significant? What is the need to talk about single people?
Absolutely. Single studies is it's a developing field. It's a very new field. And the best definition that I can come up with is it's essentially a study of singlehood and its validity in our lives. And it's very important because there are a number of programs at universities throughout the world that focus on marriage and family studies. And the underlying goal of those programs is to promote marriage and the nuclear family as institutions. And they are dominant institutions throughout the world. But what a lot of these scholars don't necessarily see is that there are a lot of ways to live and to form relationships outside of a nuclear family unit. So that's where the significance comes in, because more and more people are foregoing the institution of marriage, whether it's by choice or by circumstance. So as the rate of single people who are living alone continues to rise, this field is going to be very important. It is very important, but it's going to be even more so as these trends continue. And there is this need to discuss this, because singles they're part of the market. They consume products, they produce products, just like married folks do, and they're going to be taking on positions of power in the future. So this could really shape the dynamics of how our society works. And the beautiful thing about single studies is that it's such an interdisciplinary field. And you know, you're both the sociology professors. I teach in rhetoric and writing studies in the humanities, and we'll talk about the media a little bit, but I study media and how singles are portrayed. But in our collection, we have a number of different disciplines being represented. We have essays on literature, sociology, political science, arts, media discourse. So there are all kinds of overlaps in these different disciplines. So as the population of singles grows, it's going to be very important to discuss this, and not in a way that compares single people with married people, and not in a way that laments the rise of single people. There are too many articles in scholarly and popular publications that talk about the rise of single people as a negative thing. And it's really not, because there are so many other ways that people can find fulfillment outside of a nuclear family unit.
I think what you mentioned about existing representations of singlehood is really important. And I want to know more from both of you about the historical evolution of the discipline. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Sure, Rituparna. So the thing is, single studies as a discipline is fairly new. It's only come about in the 21st century. And it's not that scholars have not been writing about singlehood, let's say, in the 1990s or the 1980s. But it's only 2005, 6, and 7 that Bella De Paolo said that. One, she coined the term singlism in 2005. Then in 2006, she wrote a book, Singled Out, which is the, I would say, the pioneering book on single studies. And then in 2007, along with Rachel Moran and Caitrin Mugger, she said that we need to include singlehood in higher education and in research, right? So that is the moment when, I would say, that articulation of single studies started to happen. And around 2020-2021, she wrote in the journal Science that we need a discipline called single studies. And that's one of the reasons why Craig and me, around 2020, we started teaching our courses on single studies. Right? So it's a fairly new discipline, but that doesn't mean that research on singlehood hasn't happened over the last, I would say, 30, 40 years. But as a discipline, I would say it's fairly young. It's barely 20 years old.
Thank you so much, Ketaki, for that response. I think it's really important to situate the location and the history of singlehood studies or single studies. So as scholars of singlehood, how do you understand marriage? How do you look at it?
Okay, so a lot of people they expect that since I study singlehood and since I'm very much a proponent of happy single living, that I'm just going to desecrate marriage. And that's not true at all. Marriage is a totally valid way of living. And there are people who do find fulfillment out of it. But I am going to quote a author and podcaster, Peter McGraw, who has a wonderful podcast and new book out called Solo. And his take on marriage is that it's overprescribed. And the way I understand it is that it's too often really a default option for a lot of people, that it just seems to be something that is expected from people who live in our world. And it's considered a milestone, a marker of adulthood. And I don't think that's necessarily true, that there are plenty of other ways that one can live fruitfully without having married. And in the United States in 2015, a law was passed that allowed LGBTQ people in the LGBTQ community to get married. And I'm totally in favor of that ruling. But the problem is, in a lot of the language that was used during this ruling, Senator Anthony Kennedy essentially said that no longer can people be condemned to live in loneliness. So in this way, he's conflating loneliness with the lack of being able to get married, and that's not true. And this ruling was very popular because people in the LGBTQ community can now have the same legal rights as people who as straight people who get married. So in this respect, my thinking is, why should people have to get married? to get those rights? Why can't they, like, for example, in the United States, a person can leave Social Security benefits to a spouse or a child, but they wouldn't be able to do so for a sibling or a close friend or even a domestic partner, even if they've been romantically involved for a decade or more. If they don't sign that piece of paper that says husband or wife, then they're not entitled to those benefits. So I don't put down marriage at all. People can function quite well in it, but it is very overprescribed, particularly with respect to the legal privileges it offers and all kinds of other privileges. Well, I worked for a company once that gave a $2,000 gift to an employee if they got married. And why is that rewarded? Shouldn't the rewards be more about of the work that's being done rather than what one does in one's personal life? Additionally, the cost of weddings is a big industry as well. And I believe in 2021, the average married couple spent $34,000 on their own wedding. If you think about a wedding, all these things cost money. Booking a hall, catering, music, the wedding dress, the tuxedo, all of those things add up. So why is it such a big industry, and why does it get that privilege? So that's ultimately how I understand marriage. Not wrong per se, but way overprescribed.
Right. Interesting. And, you know, you also did mention that the number of single people will increase with time. So what are some of the factors that are pushing the trend of singlehood? If you could illustrate with a few examples from your own work.
Yes, absolutely, Ritparna. So there is two scholars, Eric Klinenberg and Eliakim Kislev, who have spoken about the factors, the number of factors that have pushed the trend of singlehood. Right. So I'm just going to combine and say, so one is migration. Second, I'm just going to list them out and then we'll talk about them in detail. One is migration. Second is urbanization, the rise of urban spaces, not necessarily cities, but cities as well as urban spaces. Increase in education levels, the women's movement, aging alone, the rise in communications revolution. So I'll just give a few examples, especially in the Indian context. We have seen with Sara Lam's work that the number of, and as well as with my work, I've noticed that a lot of women who are never married, who are single, have had access to higher education, have PhDs. That is one thing. So education does either delay marriage or lead to no marriage or no partnership. Secondly, the communications revolution. That is very clear. The way Craig and me met and the way this book happened, the conference happened, it was because of the community of single people, which is on Facebook. So single people are far more likely to use social media to connect with other single people. Right? So these are some of the factors, as well as, of course, migration. And then there is the women's movement. If feminism and the women's movement hadn't come through, women wouldn't have been working, women would have been independent and would have been able to choose to stay out of marriage, right? So there are a number of reasons why people are increasingly single around the world. I'm sure if we look at it in other countries, we will find other things. But in the Indian context, I feel one of the things that we need to add to the current scholarship is increase in education and access to higher education.
Right. I think that's also very interesting. And we were talking about this a little bit, but let me ask you in detail about the representation. So how is singlehood and then single people represented in the media?
Okay, so I'm actually working on a book about this very idea. I'm a very big cinephile, and I've always loved movies and analyzing movies. So when I look at movies, I look at representation. And In most movies, if a character at the beginning, they're typically coupled by the end. And romantic comedies, romantic dramas, those are big genres in film. Those are very popular because people who view those films are looking for some type of an escape. They're looking for some kind of a representation of how they want to experience romance. And often at the beginning of the film, the single person is broken in some way. Either they're too much of a workaholic, or they're irresponsible, or they're just very rigid, or they have some kind of defect that makes them broken, per se. And they meet the significant other, they go through the problems in the film, and by the end, having entered a romantic partnership has somehow fixed all of their problems. Additionally, in the media, even if it's not a romantic movie, a lot of times there's a romantic subplot. So if the main character is on some kind of a quest, is on some kind of a mission, like in an action movie, if they're trying to save a group of people from a villain, there's usually a romantic partner involved. So that may not be the focus of the film, but there's a romance that is involved. So in this way, singlehood is really represented in a negative fashion in film. And in television, a lot of TV series, they end with the characters coupling up. But I'm thinking of the show The Big Bang Theory, where all of the main characters at the beginning, they were single, but by the series end, they were all pretty much coupled up. And this is very common because this is what the viewing public wants to see. They like romance, so they want to see that in their media. And as far as advertising is another thing that I'm thinking of. I saw an ad for Amtrak a couple of days ago on my YouTube link. And apparently all the people who ride Amtrak are coupled and or they have kids. Apparently there are no single people who ride Amtrak. So singlehood is too often neglected by the media, and it's represented in a negative fashion in other media. I wrote an article a couple of years ago about a movie called Crossing Delancey. It is relatively dated. It came out in 1988, but the protagonist, played by an actress named Amy Irving, at the beginning, her grandmother is constantly trying to get her coupled. And at one point she says, "Hey, I have a great life. I work for a major publishing house. I have a number of friends. I've traveled internationally." But the grandmother just won't have it. She insists on seeing her coupled up with a character who sells pickles. And there's nothing wrong with that, but this person just isn't interested in that pickle vendor. But by the end of the movie, they've gotten together. So those kinds of representations are so problematic because they give this message that romance is the right way to live. And part of what I'm working on in my book is to study how people view these movies, and does it affect their relationship choices? Does it reflect their expectations? So I'll be interested to see what kinds of results that yields.
Right. So to a more general question about the book, I want to know about how you went ahead with the structuring of the book. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So we have structured the book in three large sections. So in the first section, I mean, after the introduction, of course, but the first section is called Laying the Field, where we have more introductory kind of essays like from Bella De Paolo, Adriana Savu, and then we have the essay by Chris Marsh, where she's essentially saying that if you look at the numbers, Black people, there are more far more Black people who are single than white people in the US. So she's looking at the question of race. Adriana Sabo was looking at the question of language, that, you know, how are single people called in different languages in Europe? And of course, Bella de Paolo lays the field. So in the first section of the book, we are just laying the field. We are trying to kind of give a basic understanding of single studies, some of the basic ideas. In the second section, we have is called Singlehood, Literature and Media. So there we have essays on where, you know, scholars are analyzing media texts, scholars are analyzing literary texts to understand the representation of single people. Actually, there's also one essay by Joan Del Fetor, which is on medical humanities, where she's comparing her own experience of cancer along with the fictional experience of cancer of Vivian in the play Wit. So that is something that we see in the second section. And we also have Soumya Sharma, who's talking about Valentine's Day and the representation of single people in Valentine's Day in magazines. She does a discourse analysis of that in Indian magazines on Valentine's Day. And third section is on singlehood, space and well-being, where we talk about, where we have essays from Japan, Israel and Poland. And the scholars, the contributors here speak, write about well-being. What is the relationship between singlehood and life satisfaction? What is the situation of singlehood in Japan? That's by Laura Dales and Nora Kottman. And then Elia Kim Kislev is talking about work-life balance among single people, right? And their well-being. So these are the three. And then, of course, at the end, we have an afterword by Sarah Lam. So the three sections are bookended by our introduction as well as the afterword. So we've tried to cover as many disciplines as possible within, I mean, the number of disciplines we have left out, and that's something that I will address in the last question. I will address later. So the number of disciplines that we have tried to kind of address, literature, media, sociology, demography, medical humanities. So all of these we have tried to kind of address. Languages, linguistic studies. We have tried to address all of these disciplines within the book, and we have tried to divide it that way, right? So that we have the chunks, the three chunks, as I said, in the book.
Yeah, I think what you say makes sense to me. And this is why I want to ask, how does singlehood studies intersect with gender studies, queer studies, and sexuality studies? What is the interlinkage?
Okay, so yeah, with gender studies, the different roles in gender are studied, and singlehood studies really does overlap with it, because in marriage, if we're looking at it from a cis hetero point of view, there are certain unwritten rules that both genders essentially follow, and in a lot of cases, and this is no longer the case, but traditionally, you know, at least in the 1950s or so, the man went out to work and the woman stayed home and took care of the kids, did the domestic labor. Those rules have changed, but there are certain unwritten rules that men and women do follow. And as far as singlehood studies is concerned, it's becoming a lot more popular but with respect to women not married, because marriage has traditionally been seen as a patriarchal institution, and there have been studies that essentially say that single women are much happier and healthier than married, where the opposite holds true for men. And the conventional wisdom in this area is that women tend to do most of the emotional labor in the marriage, where even in a more progressive world, they're still doing a lot of the cooking and the cleaning and the and the bills and the chores and the organizing and the social the social coordination and all those things. And that can place a lot of stress on the women, whereas the man doesn't necessarily do those things. So they tend to have an easier go of it in marriage than women do. Whereas single women, they don't have quite as much stress because they're not taking care of the man as much. Whereas men do tend to struggle with those kinds of things. Additionally, women do have a much easier time forming social networks outside the marriage. They're encouraged to get vulnerable and to form relationships, whereas with the male, it's not really encouraged. There's this idea of toxic masculinity, which is a very complex phenomenon. But one of those ideas is that the man's not supposed to be vulnerable, not supposed to express emotions. So men as a whole tend to have a harder time forming friendships and relationships outside of the marital union. So their social network tends to consist of their spouse. And for that, it's connected with the idea that most divorces and breakups are initiated by women because after the marriage, they tend to have a much easier time navigating singlehood than men do. So it's very important that singlehood studies interject with gender studies in this respect, so that we can look at it in how different genders are affected. And as far as queer studies, if we look at again with the idea of marriage in the LGBTQ community, again, why do people need to become married in order to receive those benefits? And I've read things about queering singlehood where it essentially goes against this norm of marriage. So if we look at it, if we look at singlehood studies from the angle of queer studies, we really need to give it its just due in that we queer it and we look at it as something that's a positive deviance. And sexuality studies as well. In this respect, a lot of people identify as asexual and aromantic, and a lot of asexuals do get married. Also, people who identify as aromantic also couple up or get married. But a lot of people who fall into those camps don't necessarily want to do those things. And if they do, a lot of people who are asexual do have a hard time navigating the dating landscape because sex is considered to be sort of an expectation of couplehood, of marriage. So if they don't fit into that camp, they may have some trouble in this respect. So people who identify as aromantic and or asexual, a lot of them do end up single again, either by choice or by circumstance. So those kinds of studies do need to be a part of this umbrella of singlehood studies because that population is affected in that regard.
Right. So lastly, I would also want to know about the future scope of this field as well as, such kind of studies.
Sure. So I feel the future of single studies is very bright because there's a lot of scope, especially in the Indian context or in contexts where there is not much research on singlehood. But there are certain intersections with disciplines which I feel have not been explored much or are being explored but need much more attention. So one of them is law, and this is something that I've included recently in my syllabus, and there has been a lot of conversation around the intersection between law and singlehood. So that is one thing, that is one kind of scope, future scope of single studies. The second is to look at economy, the singles economy, right? And that is something that we're beginning to look at, as Craig has already said, that single people, that the market is catering to single people. So what is the singles economy? And are single people really then catering to capitalism, or are we in the same way, the way the pink economy is going? Do we want to kind of go down the same line, or do we want to have a critique of neoliberalism, right? So that is one thing. Thirdly, there has been some research, historical research on single women and single men in the American context, in the European context, but I don't feel in the other, let's say in the Indian context, in another. So history as a discipline, I feel, needs to engage more with single studies. So there are a number of disciplines. So for instance, economics, history, legal studies, they need to kind of engage with the population of single people or with singlehood or with single studies so that new knowledge is produced. So in that sense, I feel at least within these three fields, and I'm sure there's a lot more political science, just generally politics, voting, and that's something that Bella and a number of scholars have written about. So what is the vote bank? You know, do single people form a large vote bank or not? So, you know, political science. So there are a number of disciplines which will intersect with the study of singlehood and single studies. And that will be the future scope of the field.
Right. Thank you so much, Ketaki and Craig, for talking to me and giving this time to NBN. I really enjoyed reading this edited collection, and I am very sure that our listeners are also going to enjoy listening to both of you talk about it and hopefully pick up a copy of the book. So thank you once again for talking to me.
Thank you for having us. Pleasure.
Thank you, Rituparna.